Chapter 21, True Beauty. September 2009. In the summer, I reflected on what a hard year it had been. I knew there had been a reason that God was allowing me to go through this, and that it was my job to find some sort of light in all of it. I knew he wouldn't want me to suffer and have nothing to show for it. I'd become a punchline for weight jokes, tried to have a normal relationship, then gone running back into the arms of a man who tortured me. I was offered a television show, The Price of Beauty, where I would travel the world to examine what different cultures find beautiful. I knew it could be a way to show how we women try so hard to contort ourselves into these boxes of what appears ideal to men and what will make us deserve love, even from family. I said yes immediately and decided to bring Casey and my hairdresser friend Ken along to be on the show with me. For me, it was a very spiritual journey, and it upended a lot of my own notions of what was beautiful. In Thailand, we explored the complicated subject of colorism and discussed the lengths many people go to keep their skin light for social status. I was shocked to meet Panya Bunjan, a singer who had disfigured herself using bleach agents. Back home, I felt I had to tan to be attractive. In Uganda, we visited a village where members of the Hema people explained to us that a woman is only beautiful if she is what our society deems overweight. We visited a fattening hut, where a bride prepared for her wedding by adding as much weight as she could. In Brazil, we examined the notion that plastic surgery was so commonplace that you were a freak if you didn't have it. Casey and I were on an emotional eat, pray, love kind of trip, whereas Ken kept trying to keep everything light. Most heartbreaking and eye-opening for me was meeting Isabel Caro, a French model with anorexia who was 86 pounds when I met her. In 2007, she became the face of the disease when she posed nude at 58 pounds for a Milan Fashion Week billboard campaign to fight the pressure on models to starve themselves. When I met her, she had worked her way back up to 86 pounds and still seemed so fragile. Isabel's disease had started near the end of high school, when she was trying to break into modeling. Around the same time, I signed with Sony. While I was told I needed to lose 15 pounds to be a success, she told me a modeling scout advised her to lose 20. As Isabel talked, it was hard not to cry, seeing the skeleton move beneath her tight sheath of pale skin. I kept looking away, but her beautiful eyes pulled me in. We were two women who had been told we needed to be skinny to be worthy. That shame was killing her, and I felt lucky to have escaped that. I asked her how she found the strength to be so open, showing what anorexia really looked like. She answered that she was doing it for young girls. I thought about that girl I heard about in Scottsdale. I decided I needed to do more. Not just withstand judgment, but call it out. I left her side feeling bulletproof from all the criticism I still faced about those photos at a chili cook-off, or even the praise when people thought I looked good. Nobody's words, compliments, or critiques should define the value of our souls. What if all this time our problem areas were not our stomachs or thighs, but our brains? I'm not saying people aren't cruel, believe me, I know. But we can't allow ourselves to do the work for bullies. Give a girl an insult, she'll feel bad for a day. But teach her to hate her body, she'll feel bad forever. After The Price of Beauty, I knew I needed to separate what really mattered to me and what really mattered to my ego. In subsequent interviews, I worked hard to say I like the way I look, whether I was up or down 10 pounds. All kinds of women started coming up to me, not to give me a supportive word, but to say that I made them feel good. "We look good," I would hear. They thanked me for setting an example, that we don't need to measure our self-worth with a scale. In November of the following year, Isabel died at age 28. I think about her so often, and I'm grateful for the experience of meeting her. She made her life matter, and wherever you are and whatever you believe, please say her name aloud so she is remembered. Isabel Caro. It was while we were in Brazil shooting The Price of Beauty that I got the call about Daisy. On September 14th, my sweet, wonderful dog was staying at my parents' house while I traveled. She was in the backyard when she was snatched by a coyote. The coyote ran off with her, and we never saw her again. Casey was with me when my mom called, frantic. I lost it in a way she'd never seen before. Daisy May was like my child before I was a mother, and I adored her as a constant companion. She was also, in many ways, the last reminder of my marriage. I felt a crushing sense of deep loss and a feeling of being truly alone. Twitter was new to me, and I went on to ask people to help find her. I paid dog trackers to look for her and robocalled a neighborhood. People made fun of me for caring so much about a dog. But if you've ever loved an animal, you can't fathom that someone wouldn't understand my need to find her. People contacted my family with prank leads, and some of the news stories about Daisy were grotesque in their mean-spiritedness. The journey I was on, traveling the world, and the women I met, gave me strength. I didn't know how much I was about to need it. While promoting his album Battle Studies, John gave two interviews, one with Rolling Stone that was released in January, then one a month later in Playboy. He talked like he tied a cinder block to the gas pedal, a man intent on destroying his image as a thoughtful singer-songwriter. The first one was just gross, with him talking about the women in Hollywood he's slept with and essentializing women down to their private parts. You need to have them be able to go toe-to-toe with you intellectually, he said. But don't they also have to have a vagina you could pitch a tent on just to camp out on for like a weekend? Doesn't that have to be there too? The Joshua Tree of vaginas? I only skipped through the Rolling Stone interview, but a girlfriend who cared about me wanted to make sure I knew about one sentence that actually mattered. He said lately he could only sleep with girls he'd already slept with because he couldn't fathom having to explain to a new woman that, yes, the famous John Mayer was interested in her. Did you catch it too? Girls, plural. I confronted him about it, naming another person he'd been with. Are you sleeping with both of us? I'm not back with you. Yeah, but you got my ex to break up with me, I yelled. I was living in Dallas. You took me away from something. What is wrong with me that I let you get me back into this situation again with you? The February interview in Playboy sealed it. He talked about me by name in the most degrading terms. You can look it up because I had to be asked about those quotes in every interview I did for about 3 years. I scanned it more than I read it, horrified at whatever paragraph my eyes landed on. He called me sexual napalm and said he wanted to snort me like a drug. If I had charged him $10,000 to sleep with me, he'd sell everything he had to keep doing it. He also used the N-word and said he wasn't attracted to black women. He wasn't even interviewing, he was jawning. He opened the spigot of his mouth, and that's what poured out. This time, John emailed me a letter apologizing. It was the kind of letter that might have worked on me before I'd met women around the world who were facing their own reckonings on what they were willing to do or become just to be loved. Well, I set myself down and wrote him a letter back. This one I didn't have anyone proofread to impress him because I had no interest in impressing him or even seeing him again. It was a goodbye letter. He did this to me just as I was about to do a press tour to promote The Price of Beauty, a passion project about female empowerment. And almost every interview began with a reference to me being sexual napalm. I found if I made a joke about it saying he gave away my game because everybody thinks I'm the nice girl, the interviewer at least moved on quickly. But the quotes followed me everywhere. Never had I felt men undress me with their eyes like then, and I was a freaking pop star. I was used to that, but this was something on another level. The guy got on the school intercom and said I was crazy in bed. I didn't accept his apology. I deleted all his contact information from my phone. I was done with this man in a way I never thought was possible. When he reached out to me, I changed my number and changed my email. Delete. Look, I hold on to everybody. If I think about it, I can really start to hurt about past relationships. I can go there so easily because I gave so much of my time and myself to these guys. You feel like you need some return on that investment, but sometimes it's just personal growth. You probably have that someone too. I think it's okay every now and again to reflect on that time. Get down the box from the top shelf of the emotional closet and marvel at the things that used to mean so much. The keepsakes of our mistakes. The souvenirs of lost years. But know when you start making new memories with people who deserve the you that you are now. I can't tell you how many girlfriends have warned me not to write about John. "He'll come for you," one told me, genuinely concerned. But I'm grateful he removed himself from my life so spectacularly. It cleared the way for destiny to knock on my door.